my name is Chris Malmberg. This is the Book Spider Podcast. And just by listening, you too can cling desperately to the vain delusion that these ephemeral structures we call stories impart meaning onto the world. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. And today we're discussing Otessa Moshfegh's 2022 novel, Lapvona. Lapvona tells the story of several residents of the medieval village of Lapvona and its lord. This is a bit of an omniscient ensemble story, never totally committing to any one viewpoint, but the character we start and end with is Merrick, and in many ways he's the center of the plot. There are a bunch of little reveals in this novel, the interrelatedness of these people, and the little ways in which certain connections between them are hidden. And then the ways in which they're sort of brought back into the fold, like William hiring Jude on at the manor, and Agata appearing and residing there for a while, and then William marrying her, and the ways in which these sort of connections into the past are revealed to be more tangled than we initially understand them to be. And then they get sort of like reconnected and retangled in interesting ways. There's a sort of silliness to how like everything is sort of tangled up in this novel. And yet it's one of the darker things I've ever read. And that's even sort of comparing it to The Dwarf. I think that this is one of the darkest things I've ever read. And it has these sort of structures, these plot structures that feel to me, they just felt to me like the plot structures of a comedy. Does that make sense to you guys? I didn't write that down as a question, but it was an impression that I had that, you know, and I did find this novel very funny, but there's something very interesting about the sort of progression of in the plot and the tensions that are sort of in there between these characters and their individual stories that feels a bit, not farcical, but it feels like something that, like a structure on which you would hang something that is maybe more about romance and silliness. And instead it's silliness and just totally horrifying shit. Does that make sense to you? Like, or did you guys react in some interesting way to the story beats and how they may or may not like resonate with just the darkness of the tone and what's actually going on?
I think what you're kind of gesturing at, if I'm understanding it right, is misunderstanding and mistaken identity are key plot drivers here. And misunderstanding and mistaken identity are also key plot drivers in Shakespearean comedies and just generally a lot of things that are classified as comedies. And yet, in this novel, there is no happy resolution. And the tone is actually, I think, often comedic too, right? So your point maybe is that it has, in some ways, if you were to kind of describe it to somebody, it feels like tragedy, or it should feel like tragedy, and yet both the plot elements and the tone and the kind of use of humor all connect it to comedy, and so it straddles those genres in an interesting way.
Thank you for that. I think hearing you say it, I think like I'll maybe be more specific because of like what you cleared up for me. I think the plot, the events of the plot are just despairing, like super dark. But the devices are like comedy devices, like the narrative devices that are employed here. And you're absolutely right. The tone, I think, is really funny too. There's a kind of a lightness to this omniscient perspective and how it sort of ducks in and out and in between characters that also feels like something out of a comedy to me.
Well, I think that I don't know if this pulls it away from the point that you wanted to make there, but the way, what's interesting to me about what happens in terms of the relationship between comedy and tragedy here, I think is more so that the characters consistently react as though they are in a comedy when they are actually experiencing tragedy. Or maybe not actually all the characters. Maybe I'm just thinking really of William, right? William is living through a tragedy and he consistently behaves as though he is in a comedy. And that disjuncture is really the heart of what makes the novel readable, right? Like it readable and interesting. And the, you know, one thing that you had talked about was if you were to describe the setup and the main events of the plot to somebody, this would seem like just an absolutely horrifyingly, unreadably sad novel, right? And it's actually, I mean, it's quite dark in places and doesn't feel good necessarily, but it doesn't feel nearly as bad as it could, right? It doesn't feel that bad. And I think a lot of what keeps it from feeling bad is that none of the characters really, like all of the characters take what's happening so much in stride and are fundamentally, even when they grieve or mourn, a few of them grieve and mourn, but often are just so completely unaffected by it that it makes it easier to endure because the characters are enduring it almost surreally well, right? And I think like when Merrick kills the, well, I don't think he tells anybody that he did the killing, but when Merrick kills the William's son and that has to be admitted and the body is brought back, you know, convention leads us to expect wailing and crying and gnashing of teeth. And instead, William just kind of goes, oh well. And that mismatch, I think, is kind of like a foundational moment for the novel because so much of what happens after that is characterized by these like completely counterintuitive reactions from all the characters. They all either treat everything with bemused humor or they are just kind of, you know, aloof. So.
Just to add some like tension here in amongst the three of us, and not necessarily to say that this was a bad decision, but I will point out here that this is the point where I totally lose interest in the novel, where William is like, oh, my son is dead. I'll just take Marek. That is when. So up to that point, I was pretty interested in the novel, and I thought that I was gonna be reading a pretty interesting character study of a disabled kid living in, you know, really backward times and like the horrifying nature of what that would be like. And that's at this point where William is just like, oh, it's fine, you can be prince now. That's when I was like, oh, I'm reading something different and I'm really not interested in where this is going anymore. Like what you're saying about how like the novel plays with the structure of a comedy while being deeply tragic is definitely interesting. And like on the idea level, I like it, but like as an experience, I thought this novel stank. Thought it was real bad.
Oh yeah. Wow. I was prepared.
I mean, you guys
are
like
this.
You guys are like, it's funny. I'm like, in name one funny part. Name a part where I would laugh.
Oh my God. It's hilarious. So. Just here. Like this is, I had this line set aside because This is not a large novel, but it is very hard to summarize in a way that captures all of the reversals, all of the little, all of
I thought that was horrible. Like, in such a small novel, like, we're having so many different character viewpoints, and like, none of them are as interesting as just Mark was in the beginning, and it's all but go on. I don't want to. I just wanted to say that I had a really different reaction than you did, Chris, but I don't want to like derail the conversation.
No, well, I'm just thinking, I had this line set aside, like I said. So Jude rapes Agata in a kind of feverish dream state after she escapes from the nunnery. And then she finds herself at William's manor, and William, in a very like Hans described him, he is just someone who floats through life in a way that is very unconcerned with consequence. And he decides to marry her because his wife has recently disappeared. He doesn't give a shit about that. But he marries her, and she's pregnant, and because he and the priest who hangs out at the manor are morons, they have, you know, no idea that she's, you know, not a virgin. And they basically tell the story that this child is immaculate, an immaculately conceived child, the next Christ. And Jude, who realizes after the fact that it wasn't a dream state, that he actually did rape Agata, is on the grounds. And Jude, this is the line, Jude told Grigor the truth of his situation, that he had traded Merrick for Jacob when his son had killed Williams, that Agata was the bastard's real mother, but the Christ babe was his. And that's like one sentence. That's like one sentence with this like massive compression of the sort of plot complexity of this novel. And that's what makes that sentence so fucking funny to me. Like, it's hilarious that this is like such a strange, it's so strange. You didn't find that funny at all.
No, I did. I don't think I laughed one time. I don't think this.
How about Christmas in Latvona had a strange, ominous tilt to it that winter. The birth of the last Christ was so many hundreds of years ago, and there was some trepidation around celebrating while William's new wife was pregnant with the next one. You don't find that funny?
I mean, I think it's a good turn of phrase. It's well written. I think it's too clever to be funny.
That's so interesting to me. I was prepared. I thought, Patrick, you would adore this novel.
No, too. I mean, the thing that you really like, how there are all these different characters, I thought was, it is a short novel, and to me, it felt like somebody who didn't have an attention span because their brain had been rotted by TikTok wrote this novel.
Brutal. Fucking brutal.
I'm telling you, I disliked this novel a lot. Like, I did. And this is coming, like, I thought my year of rest and relaxation was fantastic. Like, I wasn't sure about the like connection to the attack on the Twin Towers at the end. I don't know if that worked, but like as a whole, I thought it was hilarious, really good character exploration. I thought Eileen was okay, like kind of, you know, uneven.
A first novel, yeah.
I definitely like. And it's probably not that this novel is bad. It's that what it's trying to do is just something that I like. Well, I don't want to say that, like, using the structure of a comedy while being a tragedy is interesting. I laughed a ton of times while I was reading My Year of Rest and Relaxation. But yeah, I don't know. Didn't strike me as super funny.
Well, let's talk about what this novel is trying to do. And I didn't write this question down, but I'm going to deviate from my questions a little bit because I am thrown absolutely
sorry.
Total confusion that Patrick didn't adore this novel. It's like it literally is sort of like if Hans hated Cosmopolis, I'd be that surprised. But what is so like? There's a we can start with like the formal structure of it. There is a structure. It's sort of broken into parts that reflect seasons, and the ending, I'll say, to me, I don't know what to do with. There's a lot of forward momentum. To recap, basically, William is poisoned and tricked into drinking poison by Lisbeth, who herself was aware that the wine was poisoned because she sensed that the priest was going to poison her and rape her. And William drinks the whole bottle, dies. Agata gives birth to the so-called Christ child and is taken care of by the wet nurse Ina, who may or may not be a witch or some kind of supernatural being. Agata dies mysteriously while Ina sort of rejuvenates herself. Maybe those two are related. I didn't know if that was intended to be read so or not. That's a question I have. Merrick breaks into the room and finds Agata dead and takes the baby and runs off with it, and I believe to throw it off the cliff where he killed William's son. There's a lot, and then it ends. It ends before that happens. But I didn't know what to do with that or with the meaning or any sort of like larger like themes in the novel because I was just too busy enjoying myself. Which Patrick, you should just try to do that more often.
What is this
book doing anything with that, the structure, with that ending that has any like thematic meaning to it or any ideas beyond the, you know, we've already talked about taking the structure of a comedy and telling stories about truly awful things.
Well, isn't there, I swear right before Marek decides to take the baby up to the cliff, there's some kind of line about how Marek had, had always been the object of disgust and anger and hatred, and because of this he had never known how to love or something like that. I swear there's something like that towards the end. So I thought that resonated pretty well with him taking the child up to the cliff, either because Marek, having never experienced love, doesn't know how to love the baby, or maybe as an act of love decides he'll kill the baby to keep it from, you know, having to experience, you know, this horrible world that he's experienced. So I thought there was something cool about that ending. You know,
just reading the final words that Merrick speaks to the baby as he's running to the cliff. "Don't worry," Merrick says, "death is not the end. You shall rise. What are the birds but angels? You will never have to walk among the monsters. It's much better up there. You'll see. You'll see. You will be so happy and free. You'll sing."
Yeah, I mean, I think that like both of the readings that you proposed are appropriate there. potentially. I mean, I think it can both be true that he's trying to save the baby from the disgusting world that he lives in, and also that he doesn't really have any meaningful idea of how to express love or how to nurture or how to, I mean, fundamentally, like he's in a great position, right? Like he's very well positioned to raise this child from a position of power and privilege where he can use that power and privilege to kind of reshape the world that he lives in, but he's just completely unprepared to do that because of, you know, everything he's ever experienced. And that's poignant, I guess. I have to admit, actually, this is such a bleak, dark novel. And I really, especially when I read it the second time, because I had forgotten the ending, actually, after the first time I read it. I bought this when it very first came out and read it and reread it back in about, I think, March of this year. And I had, when I was going through it the second time, I had forgotten that ending. And was, you know, you have the sense in the lead up to that, that there might be a little bit of sunlight, a little bit of improvement, a little bit of redemption, finally some chance that like something a little bit better might come along for these characters. And then in the last page, it's like, oh, nope, he's gonna throw the baby off the cliff and nothing will ever get better. And I found that kind of final swerve into pitch blackness. It has a kind of aesthetic completeness to it, but it did sort of make me go, ah, you know, maybe not in a bad way. But I was thinking about like the moment when he pushes Jacob off the mountain at the beginning, right? Because there's a kind of, you know, there's a symmetry here where it begins and ends with Merrick tossing a prince off a mountain, right? Structural symmetry. Begins and ends with that event. And when the moment when he pushes Jacob off is a very fascinating reversal, because there's a technique that happens where as they walk up the mountain, we are seeing everything from Merrick's point of view and following his thoughts, and he's thinking admiring and affectionate, and he's thinking about how like wonderful and beautiful this prince is, and then suddenly just pushes him off a mountain, right? And I don't know if I can think of another novel that has used, maybe there are many, and I'm not. There's an effect there, there's a deceptive effect there, where we follow the stream of consciousness of a character, we have a sense of what he is thinking and feeling about a moment, and then his external actions are in total opposition to the internal, to the internality that's been established. And the disjuncture there is delicious. I really, really love that moment. I don't think that I adored this novel the way that you did, Chris, but I did really, I mean, I liked it a lot, you know. And that moment of reversal and dissonance between internality and action, I don't know if I can think of another moment in a novel that does that so fully and cleanly. And I just thought it was a great technique. And I wonder if there's some, if the ending kind of ties back to that too, right? That kind of like the strange contrast between truly what somebody is thinking and feeling and how they act in the world.
Well, if you know, you could, I don't know that you could, I guess, like build an argument that Merrick doesn't throw the baby off then, you know, because like you said, he when he kills Jacob, it's like something that comes out of him. He does something similar later when he throws a rock at his pregnant mother. sorry, it's just I found everything. It's like a magic trick, because I'll be honest, I dreaded this novel. Like I read about it and I was like, you know, when it first came out, and I really loved My Year of Rest and Relaxation. I tolerated Eileen. I didn't really like it like that much, but I respected Mashfig so much, and this novel sounded just unreadable. Like I would not enjoy it. And instead I found, I think I came away from it thinking, you know, this is one of the best things I've read in a long time. And I found it so because for me, my experience of it, every one of those very bleak moments, just felt so alive and strange and disarmingly bizarre. William and the priest doing like skinny dipping at night and declaring their love for each other at William's wedding, and you know, William challenging Merrick to sausage eating contests while Lisbeth has to hold her breath. Some real grotesque abuse of power shit. And yet I found the tone and the treatment of it so funny and strange and interesting. And I think that's where I get a little bit confused and maybe disappointed at the end. Cause I didn't feel that same sense of strange, unexpected humor. It just felt, it felt like a commitment to, I guess, a pitch black darkness, like you said, Hans, that I don't know if I like the ending, but I loved the rest of the book so much. I'm giving it, I guess, a little bit of space and hoping that on a reread I'll know more of what to do with the ending. But it sounds like on two read-throughs, like you are similarly not sure what to do with it other than to, you know, recognize like kind of craft-wise it has what it needs to kind of like to cap the story, but it doesn't, there's not much more to it than that.
Yeah, I guess that's about right. I mean, I don't think that the boy, maybe somebody who knew the novel better than me or who had thought about this in a different way could prove this very wrong. But I think that many, if we restrict our sense of the ending to the last page and the image of Merrick getting ready to throw the baby off the cliff, I don't know how much it matters what the ending is, really. You know, if you imagine this novel, but at the end he throws the baby. If you imagine this novel, but at the end he stands there and thinks, well, I don't know, we'll see what happens, and doesn't throw the baby. If you imagine this novel and you just chop off that last page, I don't know that any of those create, I don't know that those three, I don't know that those mean anything different, really. You know, I mean, I guess you could argue that if something optimistic happens on that last page, then it's an optimistic novel. If something pessimistic happens on that last page, then it's a pessimistic novel, right? Like maybe the whole kind of arrow of the novel in terms of hope or pessimism is determined in that moment. But everything else is so uniformly dark that, you know, maybe it just doesn't matter. I don't think this isn't really a theme novel, right? I mean, it's about abuse of power, it's about inequality, but it's like so completely one-dimensionally, like the way that it uses the themes of inequality and abuse of power are like driven to such an absurd extreme that it's a little hard to kind of, I mean, if you want to say, oh, this is just like the modern world with Jeff Bezos, you could, but it's like you're not going to reveal anything. I think it's not going to change how you think about whatever, right? Like you can bring your preconceived ideas about the world to this and it'll, I guess, act as a vessel for them, but almost incidentally so, right? I mean, the interest of the novel is really just kind of the surrealism of it, the detached tone, the kind of the constant reversals between what you would expect to happen and what does happen, right? And either you, on some aesthetic level, either you derive joy from that or you don't. But I think that, like, the as tempting as it is to try to read something into the ending, either structurally or thematically, I wonder if that might be a bit of a red herring.
What? So, have you read her other books, Hans?
I've read everything. Yeah, she's one of my. She's. I mean, Otessa Moshfegh Patricia. I still to this day don't know how to say her fucking last name. But Otessa M. Patricia Lockwood and Claire Louise Bennett. I think those are the three authors that, like, that's like my hope for the future trio right there. And I'll read anything that they do. And have, I mean, Lockwood, it's a little harder because I have trouble with her poetry, right? But, like, but, you know, I'm very much looking forward to her next book. And, like, yeah, those three authors, I'm over the moon for, and have read everything of theirs that I could get my hands on. So, and actually, I would say that, I mean, I don't know how interesting it is to go into, like, let's all rank the Otessa Moshfegs, but, like, this probably is my least favorite of hers, actually. If only because it is just so, I mean, it's just kind of this nasty, surreal dream, right? Like, Rest and Relaxation, Eileen, Death in Her Hands, which is the one that was published in between Rest and this. Those are all, you know, they're very dark novels, but they have some, they're much more, there are a lot of things that are blended in terms of, none of them are, I would say, optimistic, right? But they're just kind of more textured portrayals of, like, the things that people feel. And they feel more like something that's very tethered to, like, the recognizable experience of humanity, you know? And I find this novel very interesting as, if you think about somebody building a body of work, right? I love the idea that in her body of work, there is this book. I love that idea more so than I love this book on its own, even though, again, I did find it very enjoyable. I found it very amusing. I found it is compulsively readable. It's surprising. It's strange. There are many things that are admirable about it, right? But I think that ultimately, you know, the other novels she's written are partly revelatory, and also her short story collection, and her novella. Like, all those things are, like, they're partly revelatory because they are both nasty and gross and mean, and a lot of bad feelings pushed to a kind of logical end, but they still resonate in something in us that feels authentic, right? It's a way of kind of understanding those extremes of thought and feeling that also has a kind of a, it's like a picture that's been magnified, but is still recognizable as such. And there is something kind of otherworldly or inhuman about this that I can see why Patrick wouldn't have liked it. You know, you have to be willing to let go, I think, of a certain amount of what literary fiction is conventionally meant to do in terms of, you know, illuminating human nature or exploring things that have some bearing on life as we live it or whatever, you know. Her other work is more appealing to me because it feels more like a blended mix of feelings and emotions and ways of being that is very tilted toward, the blend is tilted toward darkness, but it's not complete. And the fullness of just the kind of despair and decay and awfulness here pushes it into some other realm that is less satisfying.
It's so interesting because I find myself in a place where I really can't read or watch stuff about children's suffering, like especially children's pain. Or I'm far more sensitive to it and find that I cannot, you know, like I don't think that I can watch Zone of Interest, right? I don't think that I can read certain novels, even though I I feel like I should in some cases. And that's a bit of why I committed to this novel for this podcast, because it was, you know, on my list. And I've read her other books, except for Death in Her Hands, her other novels. And I knew that I just really wanted to try. So I committed to Latvona, you know, kind of as a way to force myself to read it. And it's so interesting to me that, like, I felt almost buoyed through all of the darkness in a way that kind of blows me away. Like, it feels like a real magic trick, because I'd feel like I should have just been repulsed by this novel, given what I've seen in happened to my tastes, you know, in general since I've had a kid. And I just don't know how to reconcile that. That's maybe why, you know, I would put this above My Year of Rest and Relaxation. I was blown away by this. I kind of think that, like, I think it's probably a little bit like some of the other novels that we've read, though. Maybe it's more interesting as an experience than fertile for explication or analysis, because I don't really know how to talk about it in a way that isn't sort of rehashing some of what we've already discussed, which is like, wow, it's so dark. It's very jam-packed with plot details and very interesting, bizarre characters. It's got cannibalism. It has rape. It has the grossest, most depressing details about what I guess it might have been like to live in medieval society. And yet it is, at least to me, not to Patrick, deeply funny. And it felt so alive. But so it's just interesting. Maybe I'm lifted up by the fact that, like, I was so ready to hate my time with this novel, and instead I found myself having fun. So maybe that's what's going on. And I'll revisit it again in the future, and I won't be as in love with it.
I do think that there's an effect, and I feel like maybe we've talked about this effect on the podcast before, although I can't connect it to a particular episode. There's an effect that happens with certain works where if the performance of artful virtuosity is effective enough, impressive enough, there can be something heartening about that, something inspiring and lovely about that, that just overcomes the response that we have to dark subject matter, right? And I think that we've talked about that, and I can't remember what it was that made us think of it. It might be maybe something that I feel about, I don't know, like The Cure, maybe, right? Like, ostensibly that is very bleak music, but the loveliness of the craft in something like Disintegration has a sort of euphoria it induces that overwhelms the ostensible subject matter. And it seems to me, Chris, that what you experienced, I think, was such pleasure and rapture in the craft of the misdirection and the surprise and the twisting and the creativity in terms of the kind of the gulf between what we thought would happen and what did happen, and the mastery of tone, right? That the kind of joy in the craft of it completely overwhelmed the ostensible bleakness of the experience. And Patrick, you were not aesthetically moved by, for whatever kind of chemical reason, you were not aesthetically moved by those things. And so you were just kind of left with this enervating, unpleasant experience.
I wasn't. I mean, it was definitely dark. It wasn't like I wasn't like I. When you said, Hans, that you that this time around when you got to the end, you were like, ah, I kind of had that reaction too. I was like, oh, if only, you know. But I also think the ending, like the first part of the novel where we're focused on Marek and the and this ending, where we kind of have this question. I was kind of down for that. But I did have that experience too, like, but most of the time I was just bored. I was just like, it wasn't so much enervating is a good word. It wasn't so much horrified with all of the terrible things going on. It's just like, oh, it's just an endless, you know, everybody is going to be horrible to everyone all the time. And so enervating is a really good word for my experience, I think.
I can see how it might register as monotonous, right? Like it removes the possibility of, in a certain sense, it's like the novel is both deeply surprising and totally unsurprising, right? Deeply surprising because there are always weird, unexpected things happening or people responding in ways that are contrary to what we'd expect. And then totally unsurprising because everything is always the darkest it can be and everybody suffers. And so it's intellectually surprising, but emotionally unsurprising. And there's a lot of room there for individual experience.
I'm curious, Chris, why you were convinced that I would like this novel? Just because it's dark? Because I like dark stuff? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, you're pretty simple, Patrick. And you know, when I'm kidding.
That's all right.
No, I think it was. I mean, you have in the past criticized stories for not casting people in power as the monsters that they are for being in power.
Mm.
And Villiam is one of the great, great monsters.
Yeah.
Villiam for me is one of the most interesting. And I see kind of, Hans, like what you're saying, like these are not realistically drawn characters, maybe is one way of putting it. Merrick is, when he confesses to his to Jude that he's murdered Jacob, he is actually excited at the prospect of being beaten because he's a masochist. He craves being beaten and whipped. He tries to get Lisbeth to do it later. Then he wants, when Jude's not going to do that, he wants to actually die. And you know, Hans, you already said Merrick doesn't give a shit about Jacob, his son, nor does he give a shit about Deborah, his wife. And when she runs off and her horse returns with gouged out eyes and no Deborah, he is just fucking delighted. But Villiam is such a fascinating monster, and his abuse of power is so bottomless and so without any concern. And the way in which his conniving with the priest and with his accountant to basically take advantage of that power and live in luxury, maintaining his own water supply while the rest of the village starves, is, I thought, you know, it's not really saying too much about that other than just basically portraying this power as ultimately corrupting. Like Merrick himself is, you know, taken up and then put in a position of being waited upon, and yeah, he doesn't think too much about it. He certainly is concerned at times with it, but it, you know, it basically, you know, it is what it is. This lord and that position, there's no relationship between morality or capability or like giving back and actually earning that space or earning that spot. You're in it or you're not. And if you're in it, you get to do whatever the fuck you want. And I thought you would dig that. And I genuinely thought you would find it funny. I wonder if the audiobook, cause I read this on, you know, I read this from the page. I wonder if the audiobook quite conveys that in quite the same way.
Well, that's interesting you should say that, because Otessa M, however you say her last name, was actually the reader for the audiobook.
Oh, interesting.
So you would think that as the author, she would read it exactly. But of course, you know, authors aren't voice actors, so, you know, there might have been something lacking in her performance. I mean, I thought she did pretty well. I don't remember her making super distinct voices for the different characters as some audiobook actors can do, but, you know, she differentiated them. So, you know, I'm not sure. But I, you know, absolutely, I noticed that William is awful and a horrible human, and certainly you can tell that's a comment about power. So it didn't go beyond me, but you said something, Hans, about how like the reference to, it's not necessarily a reference, but its treatment of power is a little one-dimensional. And I think that might be it. I don't mind it when a book is not subtle about what it's doing, but I do like a complex treatment, as opposed to, even if it's an unsubtle complex treatment. So, you know, I'll just once again invoke the greatest writer of all, George Orwell, who's, you know, 1984 is not a subtle book in any way, shape, or form, but its treatment of power and how totalitarianism works is complex. Like, there are many different layers to how the book depicts power and what it will do and how it will act. And this novel doesn't quite do that.
Here's a question, Patrick. And I think to some extent I have some sense of the answer here, but why is we chose this as a reaction to the dwarf, right? Why? And I do think that, like, on the surface, there are many, many similarities between this and the dwarf. Why is the dwarf a perfect novel and this is boring at
garbage
best?
Hot garbage. Yeah, it's not good. It is legitimately not garbage. It just wasn't my cup of tea. I think that this novel, choosing to have a bunch of different perspective characters in such a small space, is bad. Like, you know, maybe it's not so bad in a huge novel, but in such a small space, it felt like it was really hard to get to be interested in any of the characters when, one, you're not going to spend too much time with them, and two, because of the reversals and things like that in the novel, you can't expect their arc to have anything to do with like a real character arc, if that makes sense. So those were a couple things that I thought were a weakness. The surreality of the novel, like, kind of making it
Like the magical kind of realism.
Like, yeah, yeah, the magical realism, like Ina, like being able to see a little bit by putting horse's eyes in her, empty sockets. You know, it kind of moves it into a realm where, if anything can happen, you know, how can I be interested in what will happen if anything can conceivably happen? Is kind of a thing. I think that, so those were a couple of things that I didn't think worked that well. I already just said that, like, thematically or as far as like its critique of power is one dimensional. I'm agreeing with Hans on that. And so, lack of psychological complexity because you can't follow the characters, critique of power one-dimensional, whereas that's not true of the dwarf. You know, the dwarf character doesn't, Piccoline doesn't change, but he is still psychologically complex. And if he is a representative of the prince's psyche, there is still like an arc in that maybe it's the prince who has this psychological change at the end by putting him in jail. The ambiguity at the end of the dwarf is actually ambiguous. Like you said, Hans, about this ending, how no matter what it is, it doesn't really change, right? Like the novel, like even if Marek says, well, we'll see what happens. I'll keep the kid. We can still reasonably foresee that Mark will fuck it up or someone will ruin the child's life, right? It's still like a dark, bleak novel. Whereas the ending of The Dwarf, like, I genuinely wonder, like, is the dwarf going to be let out? Like, has the prince turned a corner if the dwarf is a representative of the prince's mind? If it's the other way that we discussed, if the dwarf has no grasp of reality, which was something that I like, there was some dramatic irony there that I thought was funny in the dwarf. There's also that ambiguity there with the ending. Like, if he doesn't really have a grasp of reality, then, you know, we really have to question what's going on in the novel and what will come of it. Was that what you thought I would say, Hans? Oh, okay, cool. You're a genius. Ba-dum-bum. I'm not joking that I think you're a genius, but it's just a callback.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I'll probably read this again because I enjoyed it so much. I wouldn't be surprised if my estimation of it goes down. My one last defense of it, I think, will be I don't think that this is. It doesn't quite work, or maybe it doesn't work at all. But I thought that this, I feel like this is like the Ocean's 11 of torture porn. Like if torture porn could be breezy and then this is what that is.
Right.
I don't know how else to describe it other than it put me in such a surreal place of being just kind of like tickled by all of this incredible darkness that I kind of let it off the hook when it comes to any, you know, in such a way that like I let it off the hook when it comes to meaning more than what it is, because I feel like given the similarities between this and the dwarf, actually they're entirely different. Like they're so different.
They really
are. Like they, they resist any comparison because this is an ensemble book in which the different people that you spend time with are all just irrevocably fucked up in the strangest ways. And I found that to be just so fun. Like I don't know how to describe it beyond that, but I really do think, and this is a glimpse behind the curtain. If it sounds different, if it sounded different, listeners, my synopsis of this story prior to us talking about it, that's because I'm recording it after the fact, in part because I was having a really hard time just sort of summarizing the plot. And I just kind of gave up and decided I would record it later. It is a lot in a small box, and with because of that, I don't think that it really can achieve the depth that you crave. So, Patrick, so I'm actually, like, in retrospect, not surprised now that you found it frustrating, because it's not trying, I think, maybe to do more than to be a kind of surreal experience.
Right. Yeah. And I have never really been a fan of magical realism, and there's definitely elements of magical realism here. So yeah, it makes sense to me that I didn't quite enjoy it, even though there were certainly moments where it got my noggin whirling.
I think it's okay to this book for what it's worth, you know, Chris, if you're feeling doubt about that. I mean,
No.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to make you feel horrible, Chris.
No, you didn't make me feel horrible. I am a big boy. You don't have to like the shit that I like.
Oh, all right.
Often I think we disagree. I was just, you know, another glimpse behind the curtain. There's a scene in which Ina and Grigor are, smoking cannabis, and I had taken a pot gummy prior to reading that part of the novel, and I was just fucking, like, I was having the best time.
I get it. You were blazed the whole time you were reading this. Obviously,
I was blazed for part of it. I was blazed for part of it, but I thought that it was, you know, I wasn't blazed for all of it.
I did want to say that I thought that the character tick that Marek has of sucking Ina's nipple was pretty cool. And I thought it was a real bad choice to have Jude also suck Ina's nipple.
I thought, why?
Cause
that whole scene, Ina is making Jude cook the dead blind guy, and she's like zobbling his thumb, and I refuse to believe you didn't crack a smile.
No, I thought that was dumb. So I was like, this is already Marek's thing. Why are you stealing like a cool character trait from Marek and repeating it with Jude? I thought that was dumb.
I think it seems like Ina has a kind of supernatural influence.
Yeah, that was dumb
in
too.
The village. Through her kind of the motherhood that she it's kind of like she is mothering all of the men.
Yeah.
And there's something there, but, you know, like I said, I don't know where to take any of that analysis, and I don't know that it does go anywhere, but I didn't really give a shit because
you were just having such a good time.
Because it's so fucking funny. Oh my God.
It's all right. I think I probably thought the dwarf was funnier than you guys thought it was.
I think that's probably funny.
Yeah, but
I didn't think it was laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, no, there were definitely times that the dwarf, I just chuckled and chuckled.
Whenever he imagined, like, cutting people to pieces.
It was more like whenever he did something that made me feel like he, when he like tried to emphasize his own importance, you know, or had an idea about reality that was clearly untrue. That's usually when I chuckled while reading it.
Well, what is our next book?
Well, it's been a while since we, unless I'm forgetting something, it's been a while since we covered a new-ish release on the show. I mean, this Lapvona is 3 years old at this point, and it's probably the most recent thing we've done in quite some time. So I just, you know, to support all the up-and-comers out there, I thought I'd pick something that came out recently, which is, I have not
Chuck
read
Tingle's
this,
newest novel.
Which is Chuck Tingle's newest novel, yeah. no. I haven't read this novel, so it might be terrible. I'm not sure. But I'm going to go with Unworld by Jason Green.
Not,
oh yeah,
not Underworld, which we've already done. Unworld?
Unworld, yeah.
All right, by Jason Green. All right, cool.
Chris, was that an oh yeah of recognition?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Oh, okay.
I've not read it, though.
I pretty much just went down to the bookstore and just kind of read the spines and grabbed something. So you may actually know more going into it than I do.
Well, thank you so much for discussing Lapvona by Atessa Mashvig with me today, guys. And tune in next time, listeners, for Unworld by Jason Green.